Hi, my name's Noreen Jamil, and this is...
Emily Kate Stevens.
Both of us have been diagnosed with long COVID.
And we've created this podcast dedicated to the condition. Welcome to the Long COVID Sessions. Hi, Noreen. We haven't been here for quite a few weeks. We actually took a break. And so, whilst I will ask you how your week is, how has it been actually having a little break?
Yeah, I mean, we do take these breaks in the summer. A few weeks off takes the pressure off for a little bit, gives us a chance to reset. But I do feel that the community is getting a bit quieter now as we're heading into year four. Do you find the same thing?
In terms of there not being so much chat and so much of a kind of pushing on social media and things, possibly. But I don't think that the problem is getting any smaller. I think people are just maybe resigning themselves to the fact that there might not be anything that they can do in terms of pushing the agenda and in terms of fighting for research and fighting for treatment. I am still waiting for my follow-up appointment from the long COVID clinic, for example. And I've had long COVID for 3.5 years and I've been once. I have just managed to get a gastroenterology appointment for January. So that will be almost 4 years since I have had COVID, and gastro symptoms have been quite prominent for me. I think that there just comes a point where people just give up with fighting for some of this stuff.
Yeah, and that's kind of my point. I do feel like there's just a general, what's the point? And you see that on social media because it was so busy and so loud and people were really focusing and fighting and using all those social media platforms to talk about long COVID. And I have seen a drop in traffic. And I think it's exactly what you just described.
Do you think that we are seeing more awareness in the mainstream media at all, though?
No. Very simply, no. It's always long COVID in inverted commas as well.
Yeah, that really annoys me.
Like the so-called long COVID. And I saw an immunologist yesterday who basically said, even if your immune system is crap, let's put that politely, there's nothing we can do for you anyway.
Yeah, my requests to see an immunologist have been denied by two separate healthcare trusts because they don't generally deal with long COVID. I think that we are all aware that it's a fairly massive hit on our immune systems that we've gone through. And yet immunologists, maybe it's because of that. Maybe it's because they have nothing that they can do for you. They won't even see me.
The irony is that some of the smartest people that are looking at long COVID are both immunologists. Professor Akiko. And Professor Altman.
Yeah, a paper that's raised in this week's conversation is Danny Altman's recent review of the immunology. And I do hope that in the next few weeks, we can get Danny back on to talk to us about that and talk us through their current findings in terms of the immunology of it. Because whilst some immunologists might be saying to you, there's nothing that we can do for you, there's no way that we can possibly treat you, I do think that we have come a long way. If you think back to one of our first podcasts, when we were talking to Professor Altman, I feel like we've come a long way in terms of understanding the immunology of the disease.
Yeah, I don't know if I do, because, I mean, how much do we know about autoimmunity, really?
I think we know more about it than the way in which we treat it, autoimmune conditions.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I think that the understanding of it is deeper than our ability to actually deal with it.
I was reading an article the other day about medicine and people who have chronic illnesses, and doctors were just saying there's just so much grey area, or I would call it gaps in our knowledge in medicine, about how the whole body works together. So when one thing, like in long COVID, affects a myriad of different parts of you, that's when the medical profession falls down, because they can't just fix one thing because of the cascade effect.
Yeah, and that's a massive problem that we have, because our medical system is so siloed. There is no holistic view of the human body, let alone taking the body and the mind together, which, you know, is my biggest bugbear. The fact that you go and see a cardiologist, well, from the conversations we've had, we as non-medical professionals have understanding that it's possibly not either not just your heart in isolation that is affected, or it's potentially not caused by some kind of heart problem.
I do love the fact that you just call us non-medical professionals.
Well, I was just trying to highlight for our audience, but there might be people here who haven't listened to us before and think that we are talking with some kind of medical training behind us.
No, I agree. I just, when we look back to those first interviews, I honestly don't think we know a whole lot more than we did back then. We have a greater understanding of the symptomology. We know how to treat different parts. People have created these four phenotypes of long COVID. We still know that people are getting it, but not as many of us as who got it in the first waves. But I really feel like we don't know a whole lot more 4 years on.
What I do know,
right,
is I know personally how to manage myself and my condition better than I did 3.5 years ago. And that is not necessarily from any medical advice or any doctor that I have seen necessarily. That is from listening to our bodies and working out holistic tools that we have at our disposal that can help.
I would agree with that. But I'd also say that I have now a toolbox that was given to me by different medical professionals, different doctors, who have helped me understand what's going on. But I also have certain medications that can help me when I'm having a crash.
Yeah.
But putting it all together has been me and you, rather than the doctors.
And the community and the papers and the reading, rather than anyone directly giving you treatment. I think you've seen a lot more doctors than I have, actually, haven't you?
I think it's just because my main symptom was cardiac. And so people are really happy to go and send you for cardiac tests because they can go and look at the heart. But now that we know it's not really the heart muscle, it's the autonomic nervous system, people are more, oh, okay, you've got POTS.
Whereas I have had mainly the neurological symptoms, and I got told at that first long COVID clinic appointment that I couldn't have a referral to the neurologist because they're so overwhelmed and the waiting lists are too long. I think a lot of the neurological symptoms are pretty concerning, worrying when you're going through them. And yet there doesn't seem to be really that deep understanding about things that we might be able to do to treat them or alleviate the symptoms. I've created my own supplement strategy and I take Alka-Seltzer. It's something about that combination of high-dose paracetamol, aspirin and caffeine when I feel like I'm getting a migraine coming on. And that's the only thing that I've found that can control my headaches. That is my go-to when I'm having a crash.
I also feel like we're improving over the last 3 years. And not because of any great intervention, just because our body is actually healing.
Yeah.
It has taken years.
Yeah.
So when the first doctor said to us, you know, in the beginning, it could take a few years, we were like, oof. And I didn't believe. I thought if this went on for years, that there would be no improvement. But there has been, right? I mean, for you and for me.
Yeah, definitely. Talking personally about my past few weeks whilst we had our time off, I took a road trip around California and I do not live my life, we always say this, in the same way that I used to, but I don't think that I could have done that even 1 year ago and been okay with it. There were days where I felt like utter crap. There were days where I was in the car taking painkillers to try and get through it. But the fact that I did it and that my body coped reasonably well with the time changes and the flights and the driving hundreds of miles, it's a clear marker for me of the progress that I've made in the last year. What about you? How has your most recent few weeks been physically?
Good. Not bad at all. I had a real turning point when I had the IUD removed, because that really made me ill over the summer.
Yeah.
And it was a clear cause and effect. And anything that causes our bodies to suffer, I think, brings on our long COVID symptoms. And so then I had some issues with my long COVID, but I was still able to walk every day to minimum of 10,000 steps, little bits of running and, you know, just dealing with my kids and that kind of whole holiday absurdity that we do. But the last few weeks have been not too bad. I really was careful when I came back to rest that first week.
Which is really good, because the last 2 years, both times, you've really suffered. I don't know, off the back of the holiday, off the back of the jet lag coming into autumn, what the specific thing has been, or also you've had viruses within the family just before you've come back, but that autumn bit has been really tricky for you, but different this year.
Yeah, so far, hang on, let's find some wood. So far, so good. So let's see. I don't know how long this will last. I never think that I'm well. I know that you have this thing that every time you have a good period, you're like, I'm cured.
Every day, I'm cured.
I'm like, I'm the opposite. I'm like, yeah, today's a good day. We'll see what tomorrow brings.
You know that always in the back of my mind, I'm not. I'm slightly being facetious when I text you and say that I'm fixed.
I know.
But I really, really live in that hope. But the one thing is, I think it was Monday this week, I felt so clear in my mind. I didn't have crushing exhaustion. I woke up, jumped out of bed, no headache. I felt really good. And I really do have so much appreciation, so much gratitude for those days now, because you know that they're not every day. And I know we've also got to pace, and we've become better at that, I think. But you do have to just seize and enjoy, not necessarily in a highly energetic way, but enjoy those good days.
Yeah, I'm just happy I don't feel dizzy, or I'm grateful I don't feel tachycardic. I can go for a walk and my heart rate's not crazy. And I'm a great believer in wearable technology and stats and seeing how things have improved. And I've also been really lucky in that I'm going right back to the immunology thing. It was where I've had my lymphocytes tested and I am very deficient in my CD4. They've gone down since last summer to concerning levels, but I feel fine.
But also we have to take all of these things as a moment in time, because at the moment that you had your CD4 levels taken this summer, you were just coming off the back of having influenza A, were you not?
Yes, that's right.
So everything, this is across the board with things that make us look like we're super well and things that make us really concerned, is it's all a snapshot in time. You are having those redone. And I think that would be really interesting to see what your levels are now whilst you're feeling well. And you mentioned the other day as well that your stats are suggesting you're doing well as well, your HRV, your overnight heart rate.
Well, yeah, for the first time in 3 years, my heart rate's gone back down to almost what it was before I got COVID. So in the low 50s.
Yeah.
And that's significant, because I think your resting heart rate is a really important indicator of your overall health.
Yeah. And the thing with that is that that is something that's you're seeing consistently over the days, because you're so good with your wearable technology and monitoring things.
I do like my graphs and my trends.
I love a graph, just not about myself. So that's why I'm still resistant.
So we talked to Dr. Eric Topol, who's an American cardiologist, scientist and author.
He is a prolific author, though. He's written something like 1,300, not specifically on long COVID, 1,300 research papers.
He also has one of the most widely read research papers, isn't he?
Yeah. And is actually doing a lot for the long COVID community in terms of op-eds in mainstream news publications. So he does really, really seem to be good at getting his work and his opinions published. And his opinion is that we really are not far enough along. We are not working fast enough. And a lot of it, for him in the US, he's holding the US government to account on a lot of that and their approach.
A lot of your writing, a lot of your work focuses on the future. So how about we start with an assessment of where we are right now in terms of COVID and long COVID?
I know the index event of how I got started interested in long COVID. So if we can just take a historical step back, one of my colleagues, Julia Moore Vogel, very early on, I think it was in April 2020, was hit. And she is athlete, healthy, 30s, young children. And so I saw how devastating that was, and that cued me in, since we worked so close together, that this is the real deal. So that's how I got started to be of interest. And then as far as the future, it's interesting. So today, I got called early this morning by the Health and Human Services, the government of the U.S., because they were going to be making their big announcement today about starting clinical trials, which is about at least a year or 2 years overdue. And they were trying to make sure that I didn't say anything negative about their efforts, which I have in the past. So the future, we could be much further along, but we have not one single validated treatment for all the different aspects of long COVID. And it's so vexing. So much of this could have been accelerated.
Do you think that? Do you think that we're working slowly?
Oh, we're working, you know, at glacial speed. And actually, ironically, Julia wrote today in LA Times op-ed about her experience and how desperately we need, urgently, pressing need for some treatments. And so, no, we haven't really made any progress. It's unexplainable that we didn't rise to the occasion. So in the U.S., they've dedicated $1 billion, which is, for medical research, that's a pretty good chunk of funds. And so-called recover. So it was the right idea, but it has basically poorly executed. And then a couple of my co-authors of the review that we wrote, Hannah Davis and Lisa McCorkle, who are part of a patient-led, who I'm sure you know.
Yeah, who we've spoken to.
They're great. And they have a seat at the table of recover. And I said to Hannah, it's kind of like the kiddie table. You know, when you have a gathering and you have the adults at one table and you have the real long COVID people at the kiddie table. That's kind of what it's like, is their input isn't getting the highest level of respect that it should. And it goes along with the trials that were announced today. There were just two, one with for cognitive decline and one for Paxlovid for persistence of virus. And those are not necessarily, Paxlovid is kind of not looking great for the remedy here. Right. And a lot of things that are on the list are not even in a trial yet. Plus, making an announcement of a clinical trial, as you know, is a lot different than here are the results.
Actually carrying it through.
Yeah. So I don't usually get too excited about an announcement of a trial. The only reason today I was at all interested is because there hasn't been any clinical trial for the $1 billion investment.
Not a single one.
Well, there was one putative trial, which was exercise, which had to be the last thing on the list that you would ever do for long COVID, right? That one, I think, got scratched, but that was their first one that they put out there. But so many of the aspects of long COVID, there are really good candidate treatments, whether it's immunomodulators or whether it's things to work on the vagal nerve to block the post-orthostatic tachycardia. Postural, that is, attack hearted, or all the different components of it that we have good candidates. But it's amazing that here we are, 2023, and we have nothing. And we have tens of millions of people who are affected. I know the medical community moves slowly, but I'm not seeing anything quite mismatched between desperate unmet need and action. even when there's allocation of big funding.
So we were now 6 months on from the publication of the review that you did with PLRC and Julia Moorbagel. And we've done an episode on the review. Have you seen us moving on at all since your, it wasn't findings because you were doing an overview of everything, but collating everything. Do you feel like we've moved on at all in that time?
Not really, no. There was another really good review by Danny Altman and colleagues on their long COVID immunology. It's a good paper. So we've had more writing, but no, not in the way of action. One thing I would add, you know, that long COVID review that we did, is near 1 million downloads now, like 980,000. I've never seen anything like this in my career. I've written, I think, 1,300 peer-reviewed papers. So the interest in it is intense. It just goes along with the tens of millions of people who are looking for help, either for themselves or for loved ones or friends or whoever. I've never had a paper in my whole career that's drawn this much attention.
Now, is that downloads from patients or from the medical community?
Well, you don't know.
Right.
You know by Altmetrics that it's the top fourth, it's the fourth most cited paper this year of 2023. Of somehow, I think there's, I don't know, tens of thousands of papers.
Across all medical publications?
Yes, all medical science publications. I can actually just check it while we're talking, but oh no, it's gone up to third now. Of 443,982 articles this year published in the same time frame. That's unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it. I'm just astounded by it. It just shows you the hunger for knowledge, right?
Emily, we're doing something wrong. We're not getting more listeners.
Well, we should all be listening to your podcast. Yeah. You have a million almost downloads of people, and we have no validated treatment. I mean, what kind of a mismatch is that?
You know, it's fascinating because we, over the years, we've talked to so many doctors and researchers, and the consistent theme is that the good people that we talk to, they're saying that research into COVID and long COVID compared to the rest of the historical medical field is actually going at a super speed compared to other research.
No, I don't buy that. The UK, with the trials that they did for like dexamethasone at recovery, which is kind of interesting, recovery and recover, but they were moving at really great speed, and they tested many different drugs. But we haven't seen anything. Those were in large numbers, often, you know, many thousands, 10,000 people, which is what you need. Like today, the announcement of the NIH was 100 to 300 patient participant trial. Those are small, and you could get the wrong reading on them. You could eliminate a treatment that actually might be fairly helpful. So, no, we haven't seen anything like either the UK's recovery or the WHO solidarity, where they did really lightning speed, relatively large trials. One of the things that we haven't seen, which goes along and high on my frustration list, I'm really big, and our group is really big on digital trials, where you just open it up to anyone who has long COVID, just like what you saw with the app from the UK. The Zoe app, where they got large numbers, I can't remember the size of it, quickly, with the symptoms and whether they were more COVID, and it tracked pretty well with governmental data. Anyway, that would be a way to rapidly build a huge community. It could not just be restricted to the US, it could be worldwide. And then you can test many things through that digital tracking. So, for example, there are medicines that are already approved that you could send in the mail, like what we saw for metformin to prevent a long COVID. There are devices or web-based programs or things that you could send to patients or participants as well. So building a huge cohort and also doing certain testing without having to go through medical center and health system would be a great way to accelerate. We haven't used them. Recovery didn't either, but they nonetheless showed that this can be done with great speed and get the answer and publish quickly.
We feel that there is, but do you think that there is enough patient engagement in that sense that if you actually went to the patients and asked them to start providing that kind of digital data, that people would cooperate? Because for me, if you could do it from your own home without having to be out attending appointments and trying to get hold of drugs, it's a really attractive idea.
That's what I told the HHS this morning. I said, you're asking, they only work through clinics. You have to show up. I said, you're asking people that, you know, some people, they barely get out of bed. They can't even do their daily life activities. You're asking them to go through all these hassles when you could do so much of this remotely. They don't get it, but that's absolutely true. And that's the future of medical research. And the only reason you have to come in is if it was an investigational drug that wasn't approved or something like that. But so much of this, like enrolling and things that not considered investigation, could be done in the comfort of your home without any hassle. The other thing, I do think there would be great enrollment if the leaders in the long COVID community, like yourselves, like Hannah, Lisa, many others who I know, if they were proponents, they said, this is a really good project and you should enroll, because they have the trust. And that's important, you know, trusting peers who've been hit with long COVID.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think long COVID patients have a lot more trust in people who have the lived experience. And we found that in a lot of the people that we've spoken to. Yeah, I agree.
It's like the patients like me concept, that the patients rather talk to them like folks, because unfortunately, there's a lot of lack of trust in the traditional medical leadership community.
Yeah.
Doesn't help. Delay in doing anything doesn't help the trust factor.
No. You mentioned just there using metformin, and I've read you talking about how it's effective in the prevention of long COVID. I know that we've not yet had any actual trials, but have anecdotally you seen metformin being effective in treating long COVID?
Yeah, it's a great question, Emily. I think it's worth a shot. It's a very well-tolerated, very inexpensive drug. It does have activity against the virus.
What does it do? How does it act? Because Noreen and I have been talking about it a little recently, haven't we?
Yeah, and I actually read a quote from you recently that said, we don't know how metformin
Right? Yeah, it's one of these, you know, the word pleiotropic? It's where it has like a bunch of different effects. It's been tested, you know, in vitro and in culture that it does have some action against SARS-CoV-2, and it has 20 other different things. We just don't know, but we don't have many medicines that are as well tolerated and inexpensive with a massive track record of tens of million people with diabetes who've been taking it for years and years. And it's even been shown to increase longevity in every animal species, not humans yet. But
yeah, I was talking to Noreen about that the other day, because David Sinclair is a big advocate of metformin in terms of actually reversing aging.
Yeah, so, you know, it's worth a shot. I mean, if you put it on, I wouldn't put it on the top of the list as likelihood, but there a lot of the drugs that are on the list that are, you know, potent immunomodulators, they would have, you know, more potential for trouble. You know, like potentially suppressing the immune system, raising potential for other infections. And so, you know, it's one of those that has such a great safety profile and so such a long track record, massive track record, that I think it's worth testing. And it worked well.
It's so widely used that when it first came up, I asked another expert, I said, well, so do we then think that everyone with diabetes who takes metformin doesn't have long COVID? But that's not true. People with diabetes do have long COVID.
Right. But Noreen, it would be really interesting to look at a big data set to see people matched who took metformin who didn't, whether they had less incidence of long COVID. Because none of these drugs are going to zap it. right? None of them are. But if it reduces it 30, 40%, it would be a big win. No one's done such a study like that yet, which is, yeah, you know, millions of people, find the ones that match by age and gender and race and everything, and then diabetics, and see whether or not there's a difference among those who are taking metformin.
And that could be done through an app.
Yeah.
Easily. I mean, that's just the data collection, right?
Right, right. I mean, that's already, that data exists, but it hasn't been looked at. Like somebody like Ben Goldacre, you know, with Open Safely, he could probably press a few buttons and get the answer next week.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think it's fairly well documented, the uptick in diabetes as a post-COVID complication, whether or not that's specifically long COVID or actually it's diabetes directly from the COVID. See that? Does that suggest that it would be effective? A drug that is treating something that is also a byproduct of COVID?
It is one of the more of the pleiotropic connected dots. Yeah. It's theoretical. Yeah. I've talked to so many, I've had my own patients in my clinic with long COVID, even though I'm a cardiologist, they somehow flock to me. And also some of my patients with heart problems have.
Yeah, that's because so many long COVID patients have heart problems like POTS and tachycardia.
And I've talked through what can they do, right? And everything you can think of, right? It's from plasmapheresis and, I mean, the most complex to the least. And this would be among the least. This is so easy to try for a couple of weeks to see if it starts to alleviate symptoms. But the only way we'll know for sure, and this is, you know, the difference between going through the long list of potential remedies with a patient versus knowing for sure that it has valid backing, is a randomized trial.
So in your opinion, what are the barriers? Why is this not happening?
Well, in the U.S., the barrier has been this recover organization that's unwilling to go digital, not really listening to the patient, citizens, scientists, if you will.
Is that an arrogance from the medical profession towards the patient cohort?
That word might be strong.
Or
you know,
accurate.
In days past, they wouldn't even have had them people, right? But at least they got them on the list somehow, make it look good. But if they really want to make it look good, I mean, Hannah published in Medscape her top list of treatments, and they don't show up on the list of the NIH clinical trials. And I think she knows that this space awfully well. As an example, Lisa as well. No, I think they're not listening as much, but at least they do have them involved. And that's a step in the right direction. They've gotten the message from many of us that they better get moving here because the frustration level is mounting to the past the boiling point.
We spoke to Ziad Al-Ali, who says he has direct line to the, you know, to the big man himself in the White House. And yet still things are, as you say, glacial speed.
Yeah, glacial. That's the right term.
Although the glaciers are melting pretty quickly these days.
The government, when the president at the State of the Union address back in February, he didn't even mention long COVID. And he keeps talking about how the pandemic is over.
Over.
Well, that's the line everywhere, right? Even in the UK.
Yeah, it doesn't sit right at all. But no, we screwed it up here with the $1 billion is great. And thank goodness to Francis Collins, the director of the NIH, who made that happen. But he's no longer the director of the NIH. And it was basically given to two institutes within NIH to execute, the heart, lung, and blood, it's called NHLBI, and NINDS, which is the Neurologic Institute. Those are the two institutes that were charged of getting this done. And what they've done is they've gone through the old playbook, get a bunch of sites, give them a lot of money, and then wait X number of years to get something. And so this old playbook, not using any digital, spending all sorts of money, not doing trials, just doing observational. The first things they've done is the symptoms. We know the symptoms. We don't need to spend another year to look at the symptoms. My goodness, there's been enough publications. There's been as many publications as symptoms times 10. So we don't need that. And they spent how many tens of millions of dollars on that and time wasted? What they should have been doing right from the get-go is develop a large cohort of participants, the willing, and get them loaded with trials of interventions, whatever the law.
So the NIH comes to you with $1 billion.
Yeah.
What would you do with it? Where would you first go with that billion?
First, I'd get the million plus people out there who would unquestionably be willing participants. A million plus people with long COVID who joined with NIH to find the treatments and the cure, potentially. At least 1 million. That can be done. That means you have the president talk about it. You have celebrities who have been affected talk about it. You have the patients involved talking about it. And you get that 1 million people, and then you start testing right away. The Paxlovid question that's been dangling for a couple of years, that could have been answered in the first few weeks of this, right? But naltrexone, vagal nerve neuromodulation, immunomodulators, we could have the answers to all these if we had a huge cohort and the willingness to go digital, which you couldn't get 1 million people through clinics. That would cost billions of dollars, but you could do that easily through digital app and web, like the Zoe sort of thing. So we know we can get 1 million plus. In the U.S. alone, there's millions of people with long COVID. So getting them all in a community together to test.
Do you think it's still not known enough about, as in those that suffer it know a lot about it, but do you think in the mainstream, is that one of our barriers, that it still is not getting through either to the mainstream media or governments with the weight that it should, given the size of the cohort?
Yeah. So I guess your question is, does it get the respect, the acknowledgement of how big an issue this is? And the answer is no. We also have doctors dissing it. We have people who I used to think were credible researchers who are saying these are just malingerers. It's psychosomatic, that kind of thing.
But still.
Yeah, we have that problem. We have not only lack of, we have all the people, the pandemic's over and there's no such thing as long COVID. You know, it's over. People are just making a fuss over nothing. And then we even have what used to be considered, I consider, reasonable research people who are basically saying it's exceptionally rare, even though the data show unquestionably, we're talking about a significant percentage of people who've been hit with COVID. It may be single digit of total people, but it's substantial in the absolute number of people. And that's how you get to tens of millions who are presently affected.
Yeah. Do you think the reticence about trying drugs or therapies is because there is no A, proven biomarker, or B, mechanism for long COVID?
Right.
I'm interested in what you think about the mechanism, because either there's one or several, or because it's such a diverse group of people in terms of what symptoms they get, what part of their bodies are affected. You could almost say it's a long COVID type A, B, C, D, and could have been caused in different manners.
Right.
Is that, do you think, part of the problem?
Yeah, you're right. So as you know, there have been several papers that do partition the types of long COVID into different clusters, different phenotypes. But we have the mechanisms. I think we understand there are different ways to get to long COVID, and there are different clusters of symptoms among people who have long COVID, some mostly with postural tachycardia, some mostly with the autoimmune aspects, that sort of thing. So we're long on the mechanisms. And as you aptly point out, we have no biomarker. We have some candidate biomarkers, but none that are easily assessed in an inexpensive, rapid way that are being used medically today. I don't think that the biomarker is so critical, because symptom titration, I feel much better. I got energy. I can get back to my life and my work. That would be more important than that the biomarker got better.
No, well, I mean, the biomarker is only useful when you have doctors who say long COVID's not a thing, right?
Right, right.
So you go into doctor's office, you have a test. This test confirms you have long COVID, and then the doctor can't say, no, 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 you're a malingerer.
Yeah, we don't need it to know that we've got it.
Yeah.
But other people seem to need us to have it.
Yeah, so if they don't understand, if they don't listen to patients and people affected, and they disregard all the highly credible peer-reviewed literature, and if they still need a biomarker to believe in this, then, you know, we got problems. But yeah, I understand your point. It would help in that regard.
Mm.
And it may take some time. We're more likely to have a treatment that's validated before we're going to have a widely accepted biomarker. Because it might not just be one biomarker. It might be multiple.
Mm. This is not the uplifting conversation I was hoping from you, Eric.
But wait a minute. I still remain optimistic. I'm just dismayed at the slowness.
Are you getting people better in your, have you got a protocol or a strategy? Obviously, your long COVID patients that are coming to you are specifically affected in the heart. Have you come up with a comprehensive strategy for either improving people's symptoms or treating them to the point that they no longer feel that they have long COVID?
I wouldn't say they no longer, but I think some are getting some relief over time that, you know, they're definitely making improvement. And that's good because there's certain papers, recent ones suggest that that's pretty limited, only as you may have seen the one that suggested only 12% at 2+ years have actually gotten really, you know, marked recovery. We have to reset expectations that it might not be to 100%. But you know what? If you got to 80%, right, of your baseline, and you're currently at 20%, that's a big jump. And that's what we should probably be thinking towards. I'm optimistic we'll get there, but it isn't going to happen by naturally. It needs help. It needs, you know, just like the whole ME/CFS world was ignored for decades, and other post-viral syndromes that converge with long COVID, there weren't the numbers of people. There weren't the millions upon millions. But these people didn't get better naturally. And the work that's being done here should help, should spill over across the board for post-viral clinical impact like this.
Yeah. So you are not, so because we have spoken to people who are heavily invested in the science, doing the research, but they say that they are still not convinced that there is any one thing that can help people and that it's just a matter of time. You are not in that camp that we can just get better with time.
No, I mean, time helps, but we need to not let people go for years like this. And time will only help certain percent of people, right? So no, we have to get ways to accelerate the healing. And it's different for different people. That's why this is such a challenge. Well, you know, I don't ever give up hope. That's just not, that's the way I am. And I'm not.
No, but Emily and I talk about this a lot. We are not the people we used to be. So it's taken us years, but we've reset our expectations of what a good day looks like.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I'm getting at, is a lot more good days.
Yeah.
That's what we work for. If we get the good day ratio to a much higher proportion, we're winning. That should be the immediate goal, and that should be the trial's endpoint, is because we're treating the life of people, how much impairment versus restoration to where they used to be before COVID came along.
You say that we understand the mechanism. Can you set out for our audience how you believe we have ended up with long COVID?
Well, I think, like I said, there's many roads, many paths to get there. One that is unquestionable is persistence of virus.
And there, I read recently you citing a study that I think the Munich study. Do you think that there's something in this persistent virus in the brain, or do you think that the persistent virus is in the body part that is affected in each of us?
Well, I think the Munich study, which found the spike protein among people who had COVID, this is an autopsy for people who didn't die of COVID, but they had COVID. The fact that the spike protein was sitting in the meninges, covering the brain, in the skull bone marrow, and in the brain, it tells you a lot right there. It isn't hard to connect the dots between cognitive dysfunction and having somewhat spike protein in these places, these so-called niche reservoirs. And then we've seen it in the gut, in the biopsy of the intestine. We've seen it, read another paper just in the tongue with people that couldn't taste. And that's at a year later, the virus or its remnants or components of the virus. So, no, this is part of it. But it isn't the only way to get there, of course. There's the immune system going haywire, either through autoimmunity, self-destructive aspects, or just that it just loses its regulation. It doesn't have any governance. It just starts in attack mode. And then there's other mechanisms, of course, the whole idea of the endothelial inflammation and other forms of inflammation, the vessel wall, that there's a likely a potential impact of the gut microbiome and the so-called dysbiosis that can occur. So there are many different mechanisms, but the one that's staring us in the face, obviously, is the persistence, because there's such abundant evidence of that.
So, yeah, when you say viral persistence, do you mean active virus or just viral DNA that's floating around?
Okay, it could be any of, could be replication competent virus. It could be any remnant of the virus. But the point is, it's triggering the body to respond to it still.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's why the spike protein caused people, we think, with the vaccine to develop what they call vaccine injury.
We don't know.
Is that a theory?
Plausible, yes. Plausible.
Yeah, that's what was one of my questions, because you do cite vaccination as being preventative.
Yeah.
For long time.
And a small proportion, as you know, rare, who get vaccination and have a long COVID story. And so that's another way you could bring it together. Yes.
I wanted to look at your broad kind of view. One last thing, just a paper that you wrote recently on your Substack about the possible future COVID waves, or that we're in this endemic stage. Could you just quickly explain that to me? And to Emily and our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing it right now. I wrote that in March, and I predicted based on in March that we're kind of done with big wave surges. Unless we see an Omicron-like event where a whole new strain comes that's highly transmissible, like we saw back with Omicron. So unless we get that, which we could, we're going to see little waves like what we're having in the U.S. right now, where the wastewater is going up everywhere, not to very high levels, but definitely on the upswing. So, yeah, that's what you see when you're past the pandemic urgent state. But what we're now seeing is lots of people are getting infected. Lots of people are still getting long COVID. So endemic doesn't mean anything's over. It just means it's at lower levels that just are not, it's not contained. It's not suppressed. The virus circulates. The virus still could evolve. And in that piece, I wrote about how there's about a 1 in 5 chance we could see another Omicron event in the next couple of years. And even longer out, the chances are higher. So we can't ignore this virus. And that doesn't make it go away. And we still have people at risk for long COVID. And that's one of the things that hasn't been emphasized enough. The people who are unvaccinated, who have relied on their COVID to keep away from long COVID, they're missing out on one of the advantages of vaccination, because it really has helped added to COVID to block, to prevent long COVID. It's an extra layer of protection. But we've done pretty well for preventing long COVID, like not getting COVID, metformin and Paxlovid, but we haven't done anything right on the treatments.
It's always slightly, obviously you don't want anyone else to get long COVID, but it's always slightly galling when you ask someone with long COVID that you read the studies into these things, the metformin and the Paxlovid as preventative, because you're sitting here saying, yeah, but I've already got it. What am I supposed to do?
Right. But I think if we learn anything, this is not something anyone wants to get. And so if we can just help other people while we have no treatment, we got to really go flat out on the prevent mode of things we have. And still people don't get that. They don't even know about metformin, Paxlovid, vaccination. They don't even know that. The fact that we can prevent it tells you a lot about that it is real. The fact that there's a genomics that underlie long COVID tells you how real it is, right? And then the fact that we will get treatments to help it, help people. All these things reinforce how big an issue it is.
After speaking with him, my huge takeaway from after this conversation was that he was so empathetic to our situation.
Yeah.
Like you could feel that he could feel what we were going through and was angry on our behalf.
Yeah, he really is, isn't he?
Mm.
You just got this sort of, it's not good enough. It's not good enough leaving these people like this. We're in a frustrating position because we do have people like that who are our advocates. Even the paper that he did, the review that he did with PLRC and Julian Moore-Vogel, these are huge pieces of work and really pushing the agenda for long COVID. And we're still not getting results. I don't know how we push it further.
I feel like our voices are almost like those, the ripples that you see, you know, after you throw a pebble in the water, that the initial ripples were really strong. And now our voices are so diluted that we will be eventually forgotten. Because we were never big anyway in terms of mainstream media. Oh. But we need people like Eric to speak on our behalf.
And he says that we need people like us to encourage the long COVID community to give their data and be involved in trials, in things. So, yeah, I guess we all just keep what we're doing. We just have to try and do it a bit louder. Join us next week as we hear others' experiences of long COVID. Share your stories and questions at tlcsessions.net. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram for the latest updates. And if you found this interesting, please do subscribe.